Gang, tired of being locked down under quarantine? Tired of trying to get your band together to rehearse outside? Tired of trying to get your band to rehearse in your home? It's getting crazy. Maybe you might be too loud for all that stuff. Well, guess what, gang? Space Rehearsal and Recording has reopened safely. You wear a mask, you bring your own microphone, 31 spacious rooms, plenty of parking. Space is a great place to get all of your work done. Find them at spaceatx.com or call them at 512-448-9518. That's Space Rehearsal and Recording. Start rehearsing again. Do it.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week, whatever it is you've done this week. Maybe you had a short week because of the Labor Day weekend last weekend. Congratulations on that, having only a four-day week. It's been a busy week for me. Check it out. A few weeks ago, my friend James Robinson called me up, and he asked me if I'd be interested in hosting an event in Smithville, where he lives. This event that he was putting together called Love and Liberation at the Amani Room in Smithville, Texas. And he got Bobby Sparks, the great legendary keyboard player, to play in his band, a bunch of great musicians. Mark Simmons from Houston, this guy that plays drums for Al Jarreau, has played with him for years. Fucking just amazing musicians. Brandon Temple and the Temple Underground. He got this lady Verb Culture to come out and do some spoken word stuff over this like improvised music. Chandra Washington, the amazing dancer. She was on the show a couple months ago. Great, great, amazing movement. Anyway, James invited me out to do this, so I took off on Monday and went out there. It was a Labor Day show. And it's the first event, I got to be honest, that I've been to that had people at it, that I've been to that I've had anything to do with. I haven't done anything like that this whole time. And so I was excited to get out there and do it. It was all put together very safely. But James took this room, basically an empty room, and filled it up with nice furniture, lit it well. It was all filmed. They did some Black Fret live stream thing before. But I got out there at about 2 in the afternoon for soundcheck and got to watch Brandon Temple and the Temple Underground practice, run through some songs and just kind of jam. And then Bobby Sparks showed up and he started jamming. Everyone was jamming together. And then like the calm before the storm, the audience was let in. It was a full room of just people that were looking for something cool to do in Smithville, Texas. My friend James Robinson, he was the conduit for this. He brought the cool into Smithville, man. He brought this beautiful jazz and improvised music in just celebration of life and love and liberation. Man, the show was awesome. It started off with Brandon Temple and the Temple Underground. I got to host, so I got to bring everyone up on stage and introduce everyone and hang out with people backstage. And the whole place, like, it was sold out. It wasn't, you know, they couldn't do like a super packed thing because of social distancing and stuff. But it was sold out, and the people, like, there was a magic in the air that's indescribable. I can't really describe it in words, but have you ever been in a place that's just filled with love and people celebrating creation? And creation in the moment. These guys were all improvising for hours and hours. These guys just played music and they improvised and they just created music out of nothing, out of just sheer love for being alive. And the communication between all of the artists was just unbelievable. James created possibly the coolest thing that's ever happened in Smithville. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, I don't hang out in Smithville, so I don't really know what goes on there. But James created possibly the coolest thing that's happened in Smithville, the Love and Liberation show at the Amani Room. And hopefully this Amani Room will take off. The guy said that I met the guy that's leasing the space, and he's thinking about putting more stuff in there, more music, and maybe James will start a series out of this. Maybe people will drive down to Smithville and be a part of this amazing magic that James created. So the coolest thing about it was I got to sit down after the show at about 12:30 in the morning after the whole thing was over with the legendary keyboard player Bobby Sparks, who's played with everyone that you can imagine. He's a member of Snarky Puppy. He played on the last St. Vincent record. He's played with Marcus Miller, Roy Hargrove, Prince, his mentor, and a guy that really brought him into music named Kirk Franklin. We sat down backstage at this festival and at this show, and just hung out and shot the shit for like, you know, almost 45 minutes. Amazing conversation, amazing person. After creating so much magic on stage, it was wonderful to get to sit down with this amazing man and talk about his music career and just kind of like how he's doing. So, without further ado, from backstage at the Imani Room in Smithfield, Texas, at the Love and Liberation Show on Labor Day, Monday, September 7th, this is me and the legendary Bobby Sparks talking. Let's get down. So that was a transformative show. I just got to watch you play for I don't even know how long. 2.5 hours?
Something like
2 hours?
Yeah.
How long were you expecting to play tonight? Like maybe an hour or something?
Know, usually I just play till someone says, okay, you have 5 minutes. And we just play for, you know, till we get tired, really.
Yeah.
Especially when we're playing music that we like. You know, we're having fun. You know, time just, you know, we don't worry about the time.
No.
Just play till we get tired.
Yeah. Yeah, I was feeling you. I'm a songwriter and musician myself. I'm also in a cover band. And when you were talking the stuff about Brick House, there is something about, you said you were thanking everyone for coming and being part of this communication.
Right. That it's a communication. Like, music like this is everybody's being creative and nothing is planned. You know, you're just, it's a conversation. And, you know, it's not like a conversation where you're going to walk in the room and be like, you know, I know what you're going to say. You know what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
That's not fun. You know, so if I know I'm going to play Brick House, or then, okay, I know what I'm, I know. Ta 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 ta. Oh, dun dun dun.
Yeah.
So for the most part, a lot of time for us, that's boring.
Yeah.
You know, but coming, but in the situation, I'm not saying that it's right or wrong.
No, no, no.
It's just, you know, sometimes when you're walking in a room with your hands stretched out, you don't know what's gonna happen. It's a beautiful thing of creating. For me,
that's where I think God is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's a cover band is great, and musicians can exercise their skill at mimicking something.
Absolutely.
And that's still a great art, a great craft.
Absolutely.
But
because being in a cover band, because I've done both.
Yeah.
You know, you have to play it like the record.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great, but that's where discipline comes. I think as a musician, you need both. You need to be able to be disciplined enough to play the parts that you hear on the record.
Right.
Play it the way as a keyboard player or a guitar player, you have to get the sound that was on the record, but you're mimicking somebody else.
Right.
You know, if that works for you, that's great. But I think you still need to have a creative side where you walk in the room and you don't know what you're going to play.
Yeah. Yeah, we all need that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the moment of creation is really like the buzz, you know?
Right. Absolutely.
The real buzz.
That's the buzz, yeah.
Yeah. You've been doing this, you've been playing since you started playing when you were 3?
About 3 or 4, yeah.
What did you start on piano?
I actually started on organ. My mother is a musician.
Right.
And my aunt is a musician. They played at the same church, and I always had a love for the organ. The organ was the organ was a instrument by itself. It's a whole orchestra.
Yeah.
By itself. So I was gravitated to the organ. Most of the cool guys in the church played the organ. All the women played piano. So.
Okay.
So I just kind of wanted to be cool as a young kid. So I gravitated to the organ. And So my mother and my aunt was rehearsing for this funeral they were playing for. So, and the song was My Way. Yeah. I did it my way. Uh-huh. So my aunt got up off the organ, and my mother was just kind of working out her stuff on the piano. So I just got on the organ and just started playing the song with one finger. I was like 4 years old. And then someone came in the room and said, "Hey, you hear Bobby playing the song?" And she thought I was an uncle. She thought I was a
grown up.
My aunt. My aunt just trying to work out a part.
Yeah.
So it became a whole thing. Y'all come and listen to Bobby. Little Bobby play the song.
Yeah.
And so, and then she started playing another song. And I followed her on. And she played another song. My mama, she just started crying. Like, oh my God. They took me to church that Sunday. They had me up. And I played from the church. Went to dry and play. So I went from playing one finger to two fingers to.
Now you're using all 10.
Yes.
That's amazing. When, like what, who are the guys that you look up to?
I look up to everybody.
Yeah.
From early on, I'm a church boy. So I'm a church boy. So when I grew up, it was a guy in Corsica. I'm from Corsicana, Texas. So that was a young guy that used to come and pick me up every Saturday. I'd hang with him Saturday and Sunday. He was like 17 at the time, 16. And I was like 6. His name was Paul Lewis. And Paul would come get, we'd go to the church. He'd show me all the modern gospel songs. So he became my idol. The city loved him. And, you know, still to this day, he's bad. He's still bad. And then he taught me other guys, you know, in the Dallas area, by who was, you know, there was Burt Cross, there was Willie Stewart, Arthur Dyer, Robbie Baxter. Those are the guys that were, you know, it was, and a lot of other guys too. So they became my idols because that's who he idolized. So then every time I would go to church conventions and stuff, I would just watch these guys play. You know, like Burt Cross, you know, these guys became my heroes. Then I became a teenager and I started meeting these guys. And then during this whole time, I was playing for a gospel group called Vision. They were like a commission copy, which Fred Hammond was a part of that group. So that was the keyboard player and the producer of the group was named Michael Brooks. I went to see that group in like maybe 87, 88. Blew my mind. He was playing 5-6 keyboards at one time and had a Hammond B3 organ, Yamaha DX7. He had a Roland D50, Korg M1, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And then, you know, from there, I got on Herbie Hancock, McCoy Tyner as, you know, in my mid-teens. And then just kind of opened up. Just got turned on to different musicians. Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea. And then I started studying jazz. Got into Bud Powell and all of those greats. You know, Art Tatum. Really Bud Powell. Thelonious Monk for me. And then, you know, they started looking at Jimi Hendrix videos. As a kid, my dad always played Albert King and B.B. King, Bobby Bland. And so Albert Collins was really big. My dad loved Albert Collins. So I grew up on the blues, you know. And as well, my dad, when I was a kid, he was, while my mother was teaching me hymns, my dad's was a trumpet player. He died in 2011. He was a trumpet player, but he loved bebop. Dizzy Gillespie was his favorite musician.
Yeah.
And he loved bebop. So he always pushed Dizzy Gillespie on me, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, all that stuff, Miles Davis. So when I got into college, you know, I was kind of ahead of everybody else because I was already knew what was going on.
Right. Yeah.
Musically.
Yeah. What was, I wrote that down, Eastfield College?
Eastfield College.
In Mesquite, Texas.
Mesquite, Texas, yes. My instructor was Kurt Bradshaw.
Okay.
Kurt Bradshaw changed my life. And the piano teacher there was, his name is Gary Freeman, who lives in Tyler, Texas now. Gary really changed my life because I had never heard nobody play like that in real life.
Right.
So it was like he was the first person I saw that was playing jazz like that, playing classical music. I mean, he blew my mind. And during that same, well, and then a little bit before that, I met Bernard Wright. Bernard Wright was very important. Bernard Wright was a, he grew up with Marcus Miller. He grew up with Lenny White. And he's a great, he did records, he's a child prodigy. Can't think of.
Is that how you ended up playing with Marcus? Yeah, through him?
Bernard would always tell Marcus about me. Bernard, nice. Yeah. And then, but I met Marcus years ago when I was playing with Kirk Franklin. But he never knew about me playing, you know. He just probably looked at me as a gospel musician. But
right.
I'm sure Bernard was like, "Nah, man, if you want me, you got to play, you know. He's the next, he's the only guy that can do what I can do."
Right, right.
That's what he was telling Marcus.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then how much did you play with Marcus? Did you play on records and stuff? And
I played on two records.
Two records?
Yeah.
I saw a great live thing from a jazz festival. There's like a montage of you playing with different people at jazz festivals.
Okay.
On YouTube.
Oh, really?
That is awesome.
Oh, yeah. I played with Tower Power, too.
You played with Tower Power and also Roy Hargrove on that, too. Yeah.
Yeah, RH Factor was created in my house. You know, I was started my record around 1997, 98.
Schizophrenia.
Yeah. So the song Take It and a couple of other songs I had done. So Roy was over my house. He was like, "Hey, man." I let him hear, you know, some of that stuff. He's like, "Man, I want to do something like this." He said, I said, "Man, well, let's do it." And so, you know, Ragman, his manager, called me and said, "Hey, man, can we record everything at your house?" I'm like, "Yeah."
Yeah.
So we recorded. I brought in an engineer, assistant, and we recorded a demo of that record. Record company heard it. They were like, "Okay, yeah. We'll give you a budget. Y'all come up to New York. We'll record everything at Electric Lady."
Wow.
That was 2000 and 2001.
Was that like when Questlove had it locked out?
Well, that was a little bit after that.
Okay.
I mean, because Questlove was supposed to have been there, but he never showed up.
Oh, okay. All right.
I don't know why, but he never showed up.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bobby Sparks.
So, tell me a little bit about Kirk Franklin, because that's the one guy I really didn't know.
Kirk Franklin was a gospel artist. He's
played with him for a long time.
Yeah, I played with him for 20 years. During that period when I was in high school, I was playing around in groups, gospel groups at musicals and things, and Kirk was a choir director. He did workshops. So a lot of time he would call me and be like, "Hey, man, can you come play for my workshop? I'll pay you some money." And then he had this group that he was working with, and he was going to record this record. And these producers, George Clinscale, Arthur Dyer, and George Clinscale, they called me to play on the record, the Why We Sing record. That was the first record, Kirk Franklin and the Family. So we recorded the record, me and the band. We didn't plan on touring or anything like that. But after we recorded the record, you know, we just went back doing what we was doing, playing around town. And one night Kirk came in this club we were all playing at, the full band. He came in with his son's mother. He was like, "Hey man, we didn't know you play jazz and stuff." I'm like, "Yeah, that's how." Yeah. He's like, "Hey man, the record is coming out." This was like a year later. The record's fixing to come out. He said, "Man, it'd be cool to have the same band on the road." And we were like, "Yeah, we'll do it." Yeah, so that's kind of how the Kirk Franklin thing started. And we, you know, and I did that for 20 years.
That's amazing. Was your main instrument in that organ?
No, actually, no? I played piano parts. Guy named Jerome Harmon played the organ parts.
Okay.
I kind of switched over to organ because it seemed like people were putting me in a box.
Okay.
You know, so every time I played the organ, they would be like, "Nah, we want you on piano. You know, we like you more on piano." Like, but you never have heard me play organ, you know? So,
right.
So it's just the whole thing. And so I think during a whatchamacallit record we did live in Houston. I can't think of the name, but I switched over and just started playing organ in Rhodes. So last, you know, 20 some years, now I guess I'm an organ player now. It's all people ever seen. So
it's a lot. It's in a lot of your bios, the organ. Yeah. And also, I guess since you started on it, people assume that that's your.
Yeah, that's your baby.
Man, I want to talk to you about on schizophrenia. There's amazing string things. Are those samples that you play?
All samples.
God, where do you get those samples, man? They're amazing.
I've reached out to all of the great string arrangers because I've always had a love for strings.
Yeah, that shows, seriously,
Gil Goldstein was always, I love, you know, well, I heard that Michael Brecker Wide Angles record.
I don't know that record.
Oh, you got to listen to that record.
Okay.
It's the orchestration is crazy.
Okay.
It's like amazing. So I'm like, you know, man, I want to get into this string thing, but I don't know anything. I've never done that before. So, you know, I had a Claire Fisher do work on some of the Kirk Franklin records.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I wasn't going to be able to afford him,
right?
Because I had no budget. I did this whole schizophrenia record with my own money, favors. A lot of people showed up. A lot of people didn't. So all the string people I was calling, "Nah, man, it's going to be $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 for this, you know." I'm like, "For a quartet and arrangement?" So my friend Phil Lassiter, he was like, "Hey man, you know, you need to meet my guy, my friend of mine. He's from Dusseldorf, Germany. His name is Simon Simonowski."
Right.
Simon is amazing keyboard player, singer, but he's a gifted programmer. He programs the shit out of strings. And, you know, I heard a few things that he did for Phil. I'm like, "Well, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, you know." You know, but I just wanted the real thing.
Yeah.
You
know? No, I know.
You know, so after calling everybody, and you know, I was just like, "You know what?" I called Simon and said, "Hey, man, can you make these damn strings sound real?" And he was like, "Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah, man." He said, like, "Give me a chance." I was like, "Well, man, I want to feature you doing your thing." So I sent him like four or five different songs. Every song came back. Like, sent him another one. Killing. I said, "Man, just do your thing. My record is all about art. It's not about, my record is not about me. It's about everybody."
Right.
So just everybody, I want to feature everybody. My show is, you know, when I do a show, I want it to be the same way. You know, I want everybody in the band to have their moment, you know. It's all about, so that's basically what I did with Simon, you know. So I just wanted him to do his thing and feature him.
Yeah.
You know, say, "Man, go crazy. Because I'm all about pushing music forward. I'm not trying to do no shit that somebody else has done. You know, yeah. Or if they've done it, it's been done maybe and forgotten about.
Yeah. You know, keeping the spirit of creation there.
Creation, yeah, absolutely. I don't want to make the same. So that's, you know, not Simon Nosky, Dusseldorf, Germany.
So how much, like, how much of the record did you, like, you said you started it in 97?
I started writing in 97.
Okay.
I started recording in 99.
Okay, so 20 years before it came out. Mm-hmm. When did you finish mixing it?
About 2 years ago, I guess about 2018 in September. Because I had to put it out, I had to give it to the record company around in December. So they could put it out. It had 3 months. They need 3 months to market it.
Right, right. Yeah. How did you start it on tape?
I started on analog tape.
Okay.
So a lot of stuff I had, like, I started a lot of it when I was working with Kirk Franklin. I was cutting a record in 1999 with this group he was producing. We were staying out in... Yeah, we were pretty much living in L.A. in a studio that the record company had a studio. So when we wasn't working with Kirk, I'd be in the Studio B doing tracks. They had a Euphonics console, had a couple of Studers up in there.
Yeah.
And we dumped it to tape, 15 IPs.
Yeah.
Dolby SR, and put it back to Pro Tools.
Yeah. That's cool, man.
Yeah.
How much did you work on it, though, like, say, in the last couple of years of it? Did you
I always wrote.
Okay.
And as technology came, I would just do... And beginning at my house, I had 4D88s.
Okay.
So I had 32 tracks worth of digital tape.
Right.
So I eventually got all of that stuff I was working on to Pro Tools. So now in the early 2000s, when I'm on the road, I have my inbox, my Mac. If I'm in a hotel room at a festival, Hiram Bullock, what's up, man? What's up, dog? What you doing? Hey, Bobby, what's up, man? I say, hey, man, I need you to play a solo on this thing. Hey, can you come to my room? Sure, fuck yeah. Hey, man, you don't have to learn the song. Just come jack off on it. Just
come play. Be Hiram.
Yeah, just be Hiram.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Dean Brown. Or just whoever. I would travel with a microphone. With a microphone, I travel with everything I needed. So if I caught anybody. And plus my one of my best friends, Keith Anderson, saxophonist, he was always on the gig with me with Marcus Miller.
Uh-huh.
And Patches. So I would get them to do stuff.
Yeah.
So before a tour, I'd make sure I'd have like 10 or 12 songs just ready for just, and then I'd just get people just play on it.
Yeah.
You know, just meet anybody. Hey, man, love your work. Man, can you play on something? Come to my room. Or I'll come to your room.
Yeah. That's so cool, man.
That's how I got the record done, because I had no budget.
Sounds like you did. I mean, it really does.
Well, I had a lot of people, you know, I pretty much spent the money I had on my mixing, my mastering. I had used Basie Bob Brockman, who's been a friend of mine for 30 years. He mixed all of the Puffy, all of the Mary J. Blige.
That's why it sounds so good.
The Biggie Smalls stuff back in the, and then there was Nick Hard, who works with Snarky Puppy. He does all Snarky Puppy. And I love him because he gets the weird shit.
Yeah.
You know, he makes stuff, he takes your stuff and makes it sound like something else. And then there's another friend of mine who we used to work with Kirk Franklin together, and ended up we worked with Timbaland together. And he worked with Timbaland for about 20 years.
Wow.
His name is Chris Godby. And Chris Godby is a beast.
Yeah.
So I used those guys as well as some other guys a friend of mine I grew up with named Rod Stigger. He mixed a couple of them. Another guy in Dallas, but it's a collaborative. I take songs and pretty much figure out what kind of sound I want, and I pretty much put the engineer with the sound that, you know.
Right.
You know, at their skill level, you know.
Right.
And then I got Dave McNair to master.
Oh, yeah. Eric McNair.
Yeah.
I love that dude.
Yeah, he's that cat.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a great guy.
As a...
A great guy, very talented.
He lived here too, right?
Yeah, he lived in Austin for a while, and then he ended up working at Sterling for a while, mastering.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
James Robinson. Oh no, I'm just cheering you on. Bye, Chandra. Tell me a little bit about Snarky Puppy. What's going on right now?
Absolutely nothing.
Well, right.
But Snarky Puppy is, I think Mike has some different plans that I think he's going to, you know, Mike is always pushing everything forward.
Right.
You know, I've learned a lot from Mike, from being a side man to seeing really how it's done, how it should be done as a band. You know, because... I've been blessed as a musician. You know, I've never really had to struggle. You know, since I was 16 years old, I've been touring. I've been playing. I've stayed in 5-star hotels. You know, I've been in limousines playing with all these artists that I've played with. I'm not bragging. I'm just saying I've been blessed.
Yeah.
From playing with Marcus Miller to Roy Hargrove, Tower Power, to... everybody, you know, Philip Phillips, these pop gigs.
Nelly Furtado?
Nelly Furtado. Yeah. But with Snarky Puppy, when I started traveling with them, they traveling in a 17-passenger van, and it's 18, 19 people in the van. And no hotels. No... You don't know where you're going to wash your ass, and I wasn't used to that.
Yeah.
But realistically, that's how you do it.
Yeah, that's...
You go and kill it, and then you go back. So I had to learn that because I never...
You started off too high class.
Yeah. I wasn't, you know, to the point. I'm sitting there asking, and, you know, after the gig, I'm like, so where are we staying at? And some chick go, like, oh, y'all can stay at my house. I'm like, what?
I don't even know you.
I don't even know who the fuck you are. Like, yeah. So I've slept in strange places.
Yeah.
You know, but it was a lesson that I needed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even with my career, now I see how it's done. But, you know, Mike League and Snarky Puppy, those, the core of the 7-4 the musicians, taught me a lesson.
Yeah.
You know, and I teach that lesson. I teach that lesson all the time. Because that's how it's done. Because 30 years ago, you had a record company that took care of all the bills.
Yeah.
Stanley Clark told me, he said, man, I feel sorry for guys like you. He said, man, when me and Chick, Korea, and we were doing them records, he said, they would give us so much money, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like thousands, $500,000 just in 1973 to just cut a record.
Yeah.
You know? So now as musicians, we have to come up with our own money to record a record.
Yeah. Our generation missed out on the big money stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
I work with this nonprofit called the Austin Music Foundation. Wow. And it provides like no charge education, both musical and business-wise, to young musicians, right? And there was someone that came in, and we were having a meeting, and they were talking about, oh, yeah, this guy got signed to Atlantic. And out of curiosity, oh, no, it wasn't out of curiosity. He said, you know, and he got his advance, $17,000, and I was like, that's what you get? Shit, you could borrow that kind of money from a bank if you wanted to.
Well, that's what it is.
I mean, that's what it, yeah. Yeah, but like back in the day, I mean, even my band, when we got signed to Elektra, was 98, and we got like 100 grand. But that was at the low end, because I remember guys that had gotten signed like 10 years before were like, that's all you got? Jesus.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get a and then you have to figure out how much you were going to use to spend on the record. And all that money. So if, I guess, like, if you got $1 million
yeah.
on a pop deal, then you might spend $500,000 cutting the record.
Right.
And then the rest of $5,000 you put in your pocket.
Yeah.
You know? Or however you and your manager decide to do it.
Right.
But those days are gone now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Long gone. We'll never be back.
Is that your studio, the pictures on your website?
Yeah.
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 Got a sweet DX7 right in the middle of one of those pictures.
Absolutely.
I was like, I knew he had one of those.
That's where I started. That was my first. My dad bought that for me in 1987. DX7, I had to have that because Michael Brooks had that from Commission.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then I got the Korg M1.
Yeah, that came out in 87, right?
1988.
Yeah.
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 And that was my axe.
Yeah.
For a minute, till it got stolen.
Oh. Where?
At a church.
Oh. That's somebody, dark.
Yeah. I was at a church. And I had it in my truck. It was locked. Somebody broke the window, stole it.
That sucks. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Those things were cool. It's so funny. The DX7 and the M1 have that thing where, like, all the records that came out, like, from winter of 84 all the way up until 88 when the Korg M1 came out, all those sounds, like, it just, music yeah. sounded like the DX7 for
absolutely,
a few years.
Because that's what it was from 84.
Yeah.
That was what everybody used. I think the DX7 is the most bought synthesizer in history. I think. I'm not sure. But I think because in that period, 1983-84, everybody on stage had, each keyboard player had four or five of them.
Yeah.
Whatever pop artist.
Right, right. Yeah, I remember seeing that on like Solid Gold and, yeah. and stuff like that. Yeah,
everybody, even the bass player would have.
Yeah, yeah,
because they would layer them.
Right.
It's first, I think it was the first FM synthesizer.
I think it was, yeah.
But it was very important in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The clavinet is like that's where you achieve your level of God, like chaos that Hendrix would get. You definitely proved it at the end playing the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah.
But throughout the whole show, like, I was like, oh, that's where he goes for the insanity.
Yeah. The clavinet gives me a lot of options. Options were is like for an organ. It's like an organ or the Moog. And because I have the whammy bar,
yeah,
I can manipulate a lot of notes.
Yeah,
you know, and I love the blues, so I play the blues all the time. I play them because I have them.
Yeah.
You know? So,
are you married?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a wife and I have three kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They grew up with you going out and playing all the time.
Oh yeah.
How's the last 8 months been?
Well, it has been a blessing. This pandemic has been it has been good for me. Even though I love touring, I really like being at home.
Sure.
I really, really like being at home. You know, I always dreaded not being at home, watching my daughter grow up. So now, the last part of the last school year, you know. Well, I mean, during this pandemic, you know, I've been able to be at home and be with her.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that she has to go through her senior year in high school like this, but I guess it's just the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a mind-blowing year.
Yeah, I mean, everything from you can possibly think of.
Everything fires, hurricanes.
Like, I don't know how many people have died.
Yeah.
Like, we lost my wife's grandmother. Grandmother and her stepfather within 2 or 3 week period. We buried them in the same three within a month.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay. And they were very close, and you know, in fact, her grandmother lived with us for 12, 13 years to help, because when we first got married, we had our daughter. So she moved in the house to help take care of her.
Sure.
When she moved out, when she got older, you know, where she couldn't, she started getting dementia. So we lost her. And then during the same time, her mother's husband was struggling with cancer. So 3 weeks later, we had to bury him.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you know, I guess God knows best.
Yeah, I'm Cuban. My parents were born in Cuba. I'm like first generation American,
really?
Even though I look like some dude from Iowa named Steve. Like Spanish is my first language and everything. Really? And in the Latin culture as well as in Black culture, there's multi generational homes. Like you grow up with your grandma there. Or your grandfather, or,
oh, yeah.
You know, there's something about the beauty of the circle of life, where it seems like in general, American culture, as soon as things start getting weird, it's like, oh, put them somewhere where we don't have to see this shit right now. You know what I mean? It's frightening and kind of depressing.
Yeah, but you know, for black culture, that's it is what it is.
Same with us.
Because, you know, in our culture, a lot of times, you live in poverty.
Yeah.
So, a lot of times, grandmama didn't have a job where she made a lot of money. And when she retired, she didn't have a retirement.
Right.
So, a lot of times, the burden, grandmama might have to move in with mother or daughter. And it's just kind of... Everybody has kind of becomes a family type of situation.
Yeah. Or the middle generation starts having kids and the grandma moves in to help with that.
Absolutely.
And everybody, it's a cooperative family.
Absolutely. But I love it though.
Yeah, me too. Me too. That's one of the things I think is really frightening, because there's this sort of like fear of death in America. And I think it's just simply because we don't deal with it.
Yeah.
Like as soon as your mom or something starts getting a little loopy, it's like, oh, put her in a place and we'll go visit her when we can. And
that just should be when everybody in the house should take turns taking care of mama.
That's right. My aunt just moved in with my grandma who's 97.
She took care of you.
Yeah,
she cleaned your diapers and... So now, you know, at an age later on, it's hard.
It is.
But, you know.
It's life.
It's life. That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's what it is.
I feel like I could sit here and talk to you all night. You even surpassed how cool I thought you might be.
Oh, well, thanks,
man. You really are, like, just a beautiful person. And digging into your music for the last... few days, and just like you have a huge fan.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, also, great work on the St. Vincent record.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's you doing all the Moog stuff, right?
Yeah. And Moog and Mellotron and Clavinet. Yeah, we use. Yeah, she's bad.
She is bad. Yeah.
She's bad.
Yeah. Well, Bobby, this has been great talking to you. I'll talk about your website and everything. People should get out there. And I know you're doing some live streams. Are you doing this regular from your yard with the guys?
Well,
or is that just every once in a while?
A friend of mine named Matthew Kuzman.
Uh-huh.
He always comes. There's a club in Dallas called the Freeman Jazz Cafe.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of where everybody's playing now. Uh-huh. It's like the cool place where everybody's playing. So he comes, hangs out, and he grabs like the band and says, hey, you want to... on Fridays and Sundays, I'm doing, you know, come play in my front yard. And for my neighbors, they all social distance, and people that come sit in this front yard, and the neighbors come sit in their yard and they watch. Yeah. Everything's cool. They give an offering and they do all that kind of thing. And
yeah. Well, dude, thank you so much for taking the time after your show and everything, sitting down. You're yawning.
Absolutely.
But I really, really have appreciated the whole night watching you rehearse, hearing you play, and getting to sit down and talk to you has been really amazing.
Well, thanks, man.
Dude, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, man.
Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, creating bebop right in your face. Ugly beauty right on the stage, the loneliest monk, innovator rights away.
From backstage at the Imani Room in Smithville, Texas, right after the Love and Liberation Show on Labor Day, with the amazing Bobby Sparks. What a great conversation, man. What an amazing, amazing musician. What an amazing night of music and love. You know? What an amazing night all around. I really enjoyed talking to Bobby. You can find his record, Schizophrenia, The Yang Project, wherever it is you stream or download your music. And you can find him at bobbysparks.com. I want to thank James Robinson for having me. I really had a blast doing this event, hosting it, getting to you know, be part of the night. It was really magical, and I really, really appreciate it. So, gang, when you're out there checking out bobbysparks.com, don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you find podcasts, be it Apple Podcasts, be it Spotify, be it anywhere, basically. New shows all the time. Thanks a lot for listening to the show. Get out there and find Bobby Sparks. Get out there and listen to his record, Schizophrenia, The Yang Project, available now. And once again, thank you and love to my dear friend James Robinson, Brandon Temple, Bobby Sparks, Chandra Washington, everyone that was there that night at the Imani Room in Smithville, Texas. Look out for it, man. It's going to be great. I think they're going to do more stuff there. And it was really a beautiful, beautiful night of just love and magic. Here's some more music from Bobby Sparks. Find him at bobbysparks.com. Have a great weekend, gang. Let's get down.
Musically will murder you. So advanced, I'm so new wave. Say you wanna see the world, check my Facebook page. I'm different, I own the label, own the masters. I own my publishing, a free slave, no more masters. Huh? King, miracle, known for many things. A man of his word, play a trumpet with big ass rings. Legend in my own time, legend in my own mind. Never sold a platinum record, but I own mine. Monumental at the end of the story. I don't play for man's glory in my own category. Huh?
What the future holds. Say we know who holds the future in your hands.